You're listening to Around Comics, watching before Watchmen, Minutemen, number 2. Welcome back to another episode of Around Comics. I am Sal.
And I'm Braxton.
And this is Watching Before Watchmen, Minutemen number 2. This is our watching the Watchmen beyond Watchmen. Before Watchmen, not beyond Watchmen. That would be kind of cool to beyond
Watchmen. It is Watchmen. Beyond Watchmen, though.
Yeah. This is another episode of Watching Before Watchmen, where we take a look at every single issue of the Before Watchmen mega event. This particular episode will be about the second installment of the Minutemen book by Darwin Cook and Phil Noto and Darwin Cook and Jared Fletcher. Darwin Cook wrote it and drew it. Phil Noto did the colors. Jared K. Fletcher lettered it. There were a couple of alternate covers by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez and Trish Mulvihill.
Yeah.
Which I don't know about you, but I think Trish Mulvihill is one of the most noir names.
Well, she's a colorist, right?
I think so, yeah.
But that's I always forget to look at the other covers online.
Yeah, I just go and look and see if there's any. They're kind of cool. But anyway, before we get too far along, I did want to mention that this episode is sponsored by Discount Comic Book Service. This episode is brought to you by Discount Comic Book Service and InStockTrades.com. Do you like comics? Do you like unicorn paintings? Do you like money? Would you like to save more money on your comics so you can buy unicorn paintings? Then you need to visit Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com today. Discount Comic Book Service is the only comic shop online that offers savings up to 50% off cover price. Get the hottest books on the stands delivered to your front door. During the month of July, DCBS is offering the DC Zero issue bundle for only $87.23. Get all 55 of the new DC Zero issues at 50% off the cover price. Also at 50% off is the Nexus Omnibus Trade Paperback Volume 1. The first omnibus collection of this classic work by Steve Rude and Mike Baron is only $12.49. And don't forget the latest new series by master storytellers Alan Moore and Grant Morrison. Moore's Fashion Beast number 1 and Morrison's Happy number 1 are both half off as well. There are so many great deals in July, we can't tell you all about them. So if you like comics and you like saving money on comics, stop wasting time and get to DCBService.com today. Unicorn paintings not included.
Yes.
And yes, thank you for Discount Comic Book Service for providing us with the monies to put this show on, and this episode in particular. So let's just kind of jump into it. Oh, well, I do want to say, if you're not familiar with what we're doing here, basically we're just taking a look at each individual issue of the Before Watchmen event. There's been a lot of, information. There's a lot of people coming out about Before Watchmen, before it ever even hit the stands. And we just wanted to take a look at it simply, with as much sort of objectiveness as we could. Just sort of, you know, an unbiased look at it to determine if they're on an individual, basis, if they are good or bad, comic books, not anything beyond that. But we will be talking about them in depth. There will be spoilers about the book. As we go along here, so if you haven't read it yet, or you know, whatever, you want to read it but you haven't gotten to it, I would suggest waiting, because we're going to talk about it right now.
Noi, as Northern Irish people say, right noi.
They do?
Yes, they do. They say noi. When you hear noi. Northern Irish people say down, now, they have this really cool way of doing it.
Noi. I don't even think I can really
Yeah.
Pronounce
dying.
It. Dying.
Dying.
Get dying. Dying. Are you sure that doesn't sound...
I'm absolutely positive.
I don't understand that at all. Makes no sense. All right, well, let's just jump in. This is the first of the number twos. We've gone through the number ones so far that have been released. This is the first number two, so that's sort of interesting. And we pick up with Hollis Mason, and we pick up with sort of the same circle motif that Darwin Cook had in the opening of the first issue of this.
Yeah, which is, I think, something, even the eggs at the bottom of the page is something so very Watchmen-esque, yeah, about these extreme close-ups and circles.
Yeah, and this, you know, I think so far Darwin has done a nice job of sort of combining what he does, which is the sort of retro cartoony look with, you know, the nine-panel grid and giving it a little bit of the Watchmen flair, but that's what he does. He's just awesome. We open up with Hollis sitting in a diner eating breakfast, some ham and eggs maybe, with his agent, Larry. I can't
pronounce. Schick Schneider.
Schick Schneider.
Larry is he's the agent of the whole Minutemen back in the day, right? He's the
That's
same.
Correct. Yes.
It's the same Larry. Yes.
He was married to Sally. Her first husband. Yeah. It's the same Larry, and now we see them. It's 1962. They're talking about Hollis's book Under the Hood, which Larry is sort of going over as maybe kind of an editor, but you know, it's his agent, so he's taking a look at it before he's, you know, pushing it along to the publisher. And Larry's a little concerned because he feels like it's too revealing about certain things.
Yeah. A little too truthful.
A little too truthful. And we start to see, you know, the difference between someone like Larry and someone like Hollis. And Hollis is very, you know, while he's not okay necessarily with all the things that he's done in his life, or he's not happy with the fact that he's done some things, he has some regrets, he's okay with the truth of it. You know what I mean? Like, he's okay going, well, I did this. It may not be right, but I'm not going to hide from it. I'm not going to lie about
it.
It
is. I kind of saw that he kind of has a guilty conscience, which may be the impetus for him writing the book.
Sure. I absolutely see that, too. You know, he's older now. He's retired. He's probably looking at, you know, I think as you get older, you start to, you know, for someone like him, you maybe start looking at your legacy as opposed to, you know, accomplishments. You're looking at, okay, well, how is the world going to remember me? And especially someone that, you know, was famous, that had a very eclectic and interesting life, I think, you know, it's probably pretty common for him to start thinking about that kind of thing. And so, you know, it's led to sort of this conflict with Larry, because Larry is not happy with necessarily some of the things in the book and how it's going to reveal certain things about other people in the book, namely Mr. Metropolis, Captain Metropolis, Nelson. Oh, gosh, now I can't think of his last name. Nelson. It's Nelson. Anyway, Captain Metropolis, who, as we've seen in the original Watchmen and in this a little more in detail, has had a relationship with Hooded Justice, a homosexual relationship. So, you know, that and the fact that, you know, maybe...
Well, all he says is, have you thought about Nelson? He says, right. What about the chapter with Sally after Ursula's death? Have you even thought about Nelson? So he doesn't go into, and I guess we could talk about all that at the end of the book, because
right.
we find out just how homosexual Nelson turns out to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was hinted at and it was talked
about.
Yeah,
that's just it. It was all hinted at in Watchmen. Everything was you know, just you were just given the slightest bit of notion, but I'm getting ahead of ourselves here, but yeah, it's definitely something that's
Well, I guess the point of the sequence is sort of showing the difference between Hollis and Larry, and how Larry's more maybe worried about
lining his pockets and
maybe his own reputation and
killing Hollis. The cash cow that Minutemen were, right. I guess, as their agent. Yeah.
And then Hollis sort of, you know, angrily leaves and tells him, hey, the book is what it is. It's staying that way. It's, you know, I'm not going to change it for you or anybody else. And he goes outside and lights up one of those funny glass ball cigarette things that we've seen throughout Watchmen. And then we see this interesting scene where he talks about how he's starting to hate. He says, I'm starting to hate this city. So young and clean and electric, so buttoned down and tame. We could never have pulled what we did in today's world. And I found that interesting. It's 1962. And, you know, the world has definitely changed. You see a sign on a van about Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah.
Sort of the introduction of him and how maybe his appearance has changed the world and how, you know.
Well, and he also, on the first page, the first line, he gave reference to someone who's out there catching bullets, which, of course, is Adrian Veidt. So we're led to believe that Ozymandias and, of course, Dr. Manhattan are operational at this in 1962.
Yeah, and we know that also from Watchmen that they were by then. And really, Manhattan was one of the reasons that Hollis had retired. At least that's what he had originally said, that when he saw someone like that, he figured he was
obsolete.
What
the hell's the point?
Yeah. So that starts him, you know, we kind of flash back to 1939, and he starts talking about, you know, the early years and how he was a beat cop in
his neighborhood.
Yeah, I don't know. He doesn't. Yeah, they don't say what neighborhood. It's Italian, you know.
But he lived in the same neighborhood where he was the beat cop.
Right. Yeah, because cops used to do that. They would actually, and they still do to some degree. They actually. Police officers.
Really?
Well, police officers, like if you buy a home in your neighborhood where you're an officer, you will get like, I don't know if you get a discount or you get like, you'll get a bonus to live in the neighborhood that you are an officer. Yeah, I have a friend who.
I think that's a good, I mean, that's definitely.
Yeah, it's trying to get them to, you know, hey, stay in the neighborhood you protect. Why not? So we kind of see him in this helping the people in his neighborhood, and
it's a very cozy scene. You have he's helping an Italian
kid
guy and his dad, I guess, fix the motor, which we all know that Hollis Mason's good with cars, and there's a little girl who's actually wearing his jacket or the shirt of his police uniform.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, just shows you how tied into the community he is and
right.
loved and what have you.
He was okay for an Irishman is what they eventually came to.
Bellissimo.
but he notices something in the newspaper that Mr. Musante is carrying or reading, and it's the ad that Metropolis has put out. Metropolis and Silk Spectre has put out. Calling all mystery men of mystery, masked adventurers, and costume crime fighters. It's the ad to try and get the Minutemen together.
And I love that. I love that they went through the paper to recruit, which, you know, back then, of course. Yeah, of course they'd go.
How else are you going to do it? I mean,
It
would be interesting to think about, like, how that was. Like, you would have to, like, walk into the local paper office and purchase a classified ad. You know, you could pay cash, but, you know, like, is he walking in as Captain Metropolis buying an ad, or is he going in as Nelson Gardner, you know?
Like, I guess he'd have to do it as, maybe Larry did it, honestly.
Oh, yeah, probably. That's probably what it was. Larry probably did it. And he says 2 weeks later he ended up at the audition, and so we go to a
love this page.
You know, it's funny, it actually reminds me of a few things. You know, number one being the scene from Mystery Men.
Yes.
The Ben Stiller, and where they're auditioning for superheroes. But we see we see Metropolis and Larry and Sally, Jupiter, all, you know, sitting behind a desk like a casting room, trying to find out if there's any worthy Minutemen out there for their group. And we go through a bunch of, you know, sort of silly, ridiculous, you know, weird.
The iron lid actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know, I was like, Iron Lid, that seemed familiar, but yeah, we have the Frogman, we have Liberty Lass, who evidently makes a mean brisket. We have Hank, who's a dude with a dirty sweater and a bucket on his head. Then we have the Mothman.
Mothman, apparently this is how he came to the Minuteman, right? Because he looks kind of young there, but I guess that's how he is. I don't know. And of course we have the slut, which, you know, I would love for there to be a Before Watchmen series,
about
of the slut. We can get that one in
before
as well.
Watchmen. Well, I think it's called The Pro. Have you ever read that?
I have read that. I actually sent it. I thought I mailed it to you guys at Around Comics long ago.
You may have.
I sent it to somebody, but yeah, Warren Ellis is the pro.
Was it Warren Ellis or was it Garth Ennis? Why do I want to think it was Garth Ennis?
I get Ellis Ennis. One of the two.
Yeah, one of those.
But the slut should know that the Minutemen already have Sally Jupiter, so
she's not going to out-slut Sally Jupiter. All right. And then we finally get to Hollis as Night Owl, and they quickly
shoo-in.
Yeah, I mean, they've seen his exploits already. He's well known, and they immediately welcome him to the group. And I thought the scene where they're like, you know, they welcome him in and Sally's like, "Welcome aboard, handsome." And then Metropolis is like, "Indeed." And I thought that was, she was like, "Indeed." You know, sort of like very.
I didn't notice that. Yeah.
The first time I read it, I just kind of glazed over it. But then the second time I read it, I'm like, oh, that's sort of a, you know, a little.
Indeed.
Yeah. A little indeed. And then we move on to their first mission. 4 weeks later, after apparently some training and working together a little bit, they decide to go out after some fifth columnists, which...
Some seditionists.
Some people working for communism or Nazis. Well, it would probably be Nazis. Yeah, Nazis. Hidden in... a factory somewhere in New York. So the team goes to action, and they send in the slut, I mean Sally, to distract the doormen while Night Owl and what's her name? Phantom?
Night Owl and...
Eddie, the comedian.
The comedian and the Silhouette.
Silhouette, there you go.
Yes.
I couldn't remember her name either.
And they do a really good job. I mean, they work together.
They
work well together. They infiltrated the place. They took everyone out or what have you. You got Mothman
flying overhead.
Flying ahead with a radio. One of those huge brick radios.
Yeah. Well, very World War II. You got Metropolis in a tank. Yeah.
I guess it's one of his.
Yeah, one of his vehicles. His Batmobile. His Metropolis mobile. Him and Hood of Justice are in this tank, and they kind of set everything in action, but just as that's happening, Night Owl and Silhouette and Eddie figure out that this is not some sort of, you know, Nazi...
They're not... They were believed to be Italian...
smugglers. Smuggling in guns.
Seditionists smuggling arms, and they go in, and immediately they see that it's not arms or guns or explosives, but it's just illegal Chinese fireworks.
Right. But it's too late. The plan's already in motion. The Mothman drops a bomb in from the sky. It ignites all the fireworks. Metropolis and Hood of Justice come crashing through the door with the tank. And And it was just a total disaster. There's just everything goes off in flames, and you see this cool scene of the warehouse just like fireworks exploding everywhere,
yeah,
and smoke and fire. And
yeah, I like the scene where the comedian, when the Mothman throws the smoke bomb in, and he's got this real playful devil may care look on his face, where everyone else is being, you know, cautious or whatever. Which,
well, you would think, yeah, he would be like, you know, he's 19 and he's
watch it. He says
he's just getting a kick out of everything. So, so yeah, their first mission is you know, it was kind of a disaster, but you know,
a little hocus and a little pocus,
yeah, a little smoke and mirrors, and
Captain Metropolis is able to spin it, with Larry Schickschneider. And as he even brought one of his own shells from his tank to say, hey, look, this is what we took from the seditionists. Yeah.
Fifth columnist.
And from the fifth columnist. And the public just receives them and loves them.
Yeah, they sell it. And everybody digs it. They look at the costumes and the crazy names, and they don't even question it. They just go, you know, and I think it's interesting, you know, you look at that time period, and you know, the
trusting, everyone was really trusting.
Well, not only trusting, but also paranoid. You know, this is really the beginning of sort of the, you know, the paranoia of
McCarthyism.
Well, yeah, to some degree, but before that, I mean, you just had, you know, the fifth columnist thing was became a national sort of phenomenon. Like there was
it turned into McCarthyism, because fifth columnist is basically it's people who, it's your own citizens who sympathize with the enemy.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, what are they going to do? Are they going to run arms?
But it is just sort of that beginning of paranoia, which, yeah, you know, the American people got sold on a lot of things because they were afraid. And you see this of, like, you know, their big moment is a disaster, but the American people soak it up and believe it because it's like, well, they were, you know, they're more afraid of the fifth columnist about this, you know, this invisible enemy,
sure,
than the truth of, you know, what these guys may or may not have done. So just sort of interesting how he puts that in there. I think could, you know, use that.
And Captain Metropolis and Larry early on had said that they handpicked this as their debut mission because it was, you know, it had patriotic and it was tied in with the war. And
right.
You know, there's a propagandizing effect to it. So.
And we move on and we see in the next sequence,
1940,
we see them back in the Metropolis lair, the,
finally, we have a meeting at that awesome...
At the malt brewing?
Canada Malting.
Yeah, the malting warehouse, whatever the hell it was, plant. You see Larry sort of, you know, running everybody through the minutes and saying what's going on and telling everybody what to kind of do. And there's a little exchange between Eddie and Hollis about how Hollis doesn't take to the way that Eddie has, you know, he handles himself.
How he's always looking to line his pockets.
Right. We see Metropolis sort of, you know, giving out this schedule of patrolling. And then it comes to the question of the next mission. And Silhouette immediately pipes up and you know, puts out the idea of going after this child trafficking ring that she's gotten involved with and made some traction with. And it's immediately shut down by Sally first and then Larry because it wouldn't look good. The public, you know, they don't want the public to be thinking about child trafficking and molested children when they think about the Minutemen. And,
yeah.
You know, it really turns Silhouette off to the idea of the group to some degree.
Just
and
completely, you know, aghast from it, and rightly so.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see that this group, you know, what is this group about? Is it about fighting crime or is it about PR? And it's becoming more and more evident that the leaders of this group are more interested in the PR and marketing and promoting the group than really fighting crime. And so then Moloch is brought up, and he appears to be a more appropriate type of villain for them to go after.
It's a crafty young devil. That's what he is.
Yeah. Yes. Then we see Hollis sort of, you know, going to talk to Silhouette and, you know, finding out what she's getting into. And he, you know, we see right away that he has sort of an attraction to her, whether it's physical or also.
They're on this. He likes her
morality.
Her morality, and that she's going after. Yeah. She's in it for the reason he's in it.
Yeah. You know? Then we see a scene with Larry and Hooded Justice, and basically it's...
I like how you brought that in, like, it's just this,
It's this, yeah, it's...
Just well, this regular scene. And this, oh, actually, you know what, I jumped ahead.
You did?
No, that's not the scene.
Oh, no. Okay, this is with Larry and Hooded Justice, and this is Larry basically telling Hooded Justice, hey, I don't care what you do in your private life, but we need to... make sure that it doesn't get public, because it will be bad for the group. It'll be bad for everybody if your nocturnal activities, and we're not talking about crime fighting here.
Just how public is his nocturnal? I mean,
well, I don't think it is.
What is he doing that Larry would be up to speed on him, you know?
Well, he's gay. And,
yeah,
and
no,
he's in a relationship with
they don't even know him. I mean, he just shows up in the hood. I mean, what is he walking around with his pecker hanging out of his pants? I mean,
well, I think they've been around each other for like a year, maybe longer at this point. I think, you know, it's
Larry's gaydar is going off. You think?
Well, Larry's the kind of guy that's going to want to know everything that's going on at all times, and he's also him and Metropolis are confidants, you know, they're working together very closely, so I think it would just be something that would
he's
come
probably
out.
Had the same conversation with Metropolis, and
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
But Metropolis definitely knows.
I thought the weird thing was like the room that they're in is like this unfinished room, and there's a toolbox there, and like you see Hooded Justice pick up a saw, and then he picks up a hammer, and it's like, you know,
he is an afflicted dude, man.
He's intimidating for sure, and you know, say what you will about Larry, but he's not afraid to confront someone with his.
I think maybe Larry didn't know what he was getting into.
Yeah, maybe not. But it's an interesting scene, you know. I mean, and once again, it goes back to sort of that time period and how, you know, celebrities would cover up the fact that they were
gay, and you know,
in their relationship.
Homosexuality back then is the big nasty cover up thing, which, quite frankly, as it appears, is the theme without Watchmen and before Watchmen is how horrible you know, gay and homophobia and how horrible being gay is in light of the chest out superhero normal American.
I was thinking about the, you know, with this scene, I was thinking about a little bit with Hooded Justice and the sort of dichotomy with him. I mean, he's, you know, it's mentioned before in like in Watchmen that, you know, him and Sally had arguments because he had a sort of pro Hitler stance, and it was, you know, it was hinted that he may have been this German of German descent. He was a German weightlifter, that kind of thing. And so he, you know, he's very right wing.
Oh, well, they,
you know,
thought that he was that guy.
It it was never proven, but that was
right.
Yeah, it was hinted at. And but I mean, just like if you think about that, and then, you know, think about also Hitler's anti-homosexual stance and sort of the conflict that would be in someone if you, like, say you were pro-Hitler, but then you were also homosexual, like, how conflicted would you be with that? And would that manifest itself in sort of violent, you know,
outbursts, or,
well, not outbursts, but, you know, his how he's sexually gratified from violence, and he's, you know, he's a sadomasochist. So I don't know. It's just it's more interesting, complex facets of these characters that we continue to see. Cook play with the tidbits that were given in the original Watchmen. And then, you know, as the sort of the group, you know, disbands, but from this meeting, they walk away and they're all their separate ways going on. You see Larry and Sally leave together. You see, Dollar Bill and Eddie Blake talking. And then
I forgot about this scene. What happens here? What are they? I just reread this while you were talking. They hear something.
They're sitting there and Eddie hears something like back in the house. They're standing out front, you know, waving goodbye to Sally and Larry as they drive off. And Eddie's talking about how hot Sally is and Bill Dollar Bill's, you know, telling him he should be a little more respectful of people. And then they hear something going on in the house and it,
let's
to
read
me,
that.
Well, it says, this is
what they hear. They hear a conversation. One person says,
just assumed you were going to stay. I suppose I thought we could. And then you hear
silence, your whining.
So, I mean, to me, it sounds as if it's Metropolis and Hooded Justice, you know, sort of flirting in their own weird ways. And I don't mean weird as in because it's gay, but just weird in sort of the dominant and, you know, I mean, not only is it homosexual, but it's sort of, there seems to be like a domination variable to it as well. So. There, you know, we're finding out, you know, just how kinky their
Metropolis
is
and Hooded Justice.
Yeah, and that may be why. And, you know, it's interesting in the original Watchmen and in this so far, we've seen, you know, Metropolis was, even though he was, you know, he was a Marine, he was, you know,
there's never been a Marine that was homosexual.
Well, no, I'm not talking about homosexual. I'm talking about he was portrayed as sort of, he was the leader of the Minutemen, he was a Marine, but he was also portrayed as sort of easily flustered and kind of, you know, weak,
fallible.
Weak-willed a little bit. You know, he was, you know, sort of not necessarily steadfast. And then you see the relationship with Hooded Justice is an interesting, you know, to see the opposites and how they attract possibly in that. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was kind of a weird, I mean, it was an interesting scene. It was sort of strange. Like, why was that page there? Like, I guess we're finding out about,
that they were going to stumble onto something, but
they really don't. I mean, we don't continue on with that at all. We're just left to assume.
Well, I know why they put it in there, because the comedian, he made that remark to Hooded Justice when Hooded Justice busted in and broke up the rape.
Right.
So this is probably where the comedian is starting to
figure out that
that's my guess, but
no, that's a good point. Let's see, we move on and we have, Sally and Larry driving away in the night and now Larry,
it looks like he used to get her, to go and perform at stag parties.
Yeah, that was an interesting, she asked him, like, he says there's a new, he needs her help with something. And she's like, what?
Another stag party.
Right. And yeah, that's interesting that, you know, he's kind of.
He's a pimp.
He's a bit of a pimp. He's a bit of Sally's pimp, yeah. But he pimps everybody. I mean, that's what he does. He, you know, he promotes you and sells you. That's what Larry does.
So he asks Sally if, going back to the whole Hooded Justice thing, if she would...
Beard him.
Yeah. I've never heard that phrase before.
Really?
No, I've never heard it. But I mean,
wow,
with
you
context,
are from the
I
South.
Could... I am. With context, I could figure out, you know, what it means.
Well, yeah, beard is just, I mean, it means to pretend to be, you know, the straight partner in a relationship with someone who's having.
You know, that makes sense. That argument Angela and I had a couple weeks ago where she said, I've been bearding you for years, Braxton. It all makes sense now.
Now you get what she was talking about. Yeah, that's a pretty old term, and it was you know, you would Rock Hudson had, you know, female.
He had some beards out there,
you know, that kind of thing, and to give a real world example of that kind of. And so yeah, he asks if she'll pretend to be Hooded Justice girlfriend or, you know, whatever, have a relationship with him. And at first she's like, you know, I don't think
whatever.
So. That, yeah, I'm not interested.
You got the right equipment for that, man.
But Larry, and you know, he puts his pimp ham down and he
smacks her.
He's able to make her feel guilty about it and eventually agree to do it. And then he sweet talks, and then afterwards he gives her the little sweet talk and tells her how beautiful she is. And Larry has been very manipulative, and keep going.
Get on into the last four panels and give me your rundown, what you think.
Oh,
because I first thought that she was
going down on him?
Yes.
Oh, I see, I didn't see that at all.
I had to read it twice just to say, wait a minute, I don't think that's what she's doing.
I don't think so. I think
she's putting her head on his shoulders. That's not what she's doing. But I had to read it twice because,
I mean, possibly, but I would
think
that,
I thought, you know, she's what going, is he insinuating with these silhouettes and then her head going down so gingerly?
To me it looked like she was just, you know, getting close to him and then putting her head on his shoulder.
Yeah. That's, well, this, I guess, just kind of goes into the, because they will in the future be husband and wife, so it sets it up, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it sets up that, you know, they're close, and she, you know, Larry manipulates the relationship into more than just an agent, you know, starlet kind of thing, so.
Yeah.
And then we move on to
the mission of the Night Owl silhouette and Mothman, who decided to come with them.
They decide to go and follow Silhouette to an abandoned circus area, and there's a building, and that's where she's her case has led her to this building, and she thinks that there might be someone in there. So they all go in, and this sets up a sequence of like three storylines going on at once. You have this flashback to 1920 in Germany, it looks like, at the Hopzelt Circus, with this little boy walking through a circus. You see like the canvases, the painted canvases of the tents with all the freaks from the sideshow on it. And as he's going through, we hear this poem by Robert Louis Stevenson, called It's the Unseen Playmate.
Unseen Playmate
is the name of the poem. And, so it's this strange sort of sequence, going on. And as that's happening, Silhouette and Night Owl are going into this building that Mothman has already gone ahead. He's, because he can fly, he's sort of gone ahead of them.
He's going through the top, and they're coming up the bottom,
right.
The place looks, I mean, we've got bloodstained handprints on the wall. We've got ropes bloodied on the floor.
And at the same time, Night Owl is sort of trying to chat Silhouette up. And she's very quick to shut him down, you know, by saying, I'm really not your type. So we, you know, at this point, Night Owl is not aware that she's a lesbian. But yeah, as they go on, we get closer. And then the third sequence or storyline through this, is what looks like a party.
It's a party.
You could call it that. It's something. It's an event. It's Hooded Justice.
It's an event, all right.
It's Hooded Justice and Captain Metropolis. With Metropolis is, it looks like they're in some sort of basement, and Metropolis is tied to a bed, naked or half naked, and Hooded Justice comes down without a shirt on, but he still has his mask on. And we hear Metropolis sort of pleading, saying, hey, this isn't what I expected.
Man.
Yeah, whoa.
Slow down. I didn't sign up for all this.
And then we see the circus. There's a train coming into this, you know, flashback to 1920. The poem continues on. There's a train car with cars with the circus cars behind it, and the little boy goes up to
this
him.
This little boy seems to be sniffing around a empty circus. Well, I don't know if there's no one else.
Yeah, it's at night, it looks like, and it's everything's kind of, you know, quietly shut down. But
it's creepy as hell. I mean, this is really off.
But it is, and it's, and we'll talk about it. But and then we keep following Silhouette and Night Owl, and they hear some crying upstairs, so they they rush up the stairs. Meanwhile, Hooded Justice or Captain Metropolis is crying, and he's basically begging Hooded Justice to stop because this is too intense for him. This is not what he expected, and Hooded Justice quiets him by stuffing the end of his rope in his mouth, which I thought was a very interesting choice. That was a weird panel for me. Like that was.
Yeah, I
had to kind of assume that's what it was. I didn't think it worked really well as a panel.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because it looks like the rope is laying over his mouth, and he could just easily move his head to be able to continue his bleeding.
Yeah,
but apparently, it's he's
in his mouth. I'm assuming
he put it in his mouth or whatever. He's being completely rude to him.
Or not. I don't know. It depends. I mean, I'm not sure what.
But this is all. I mean, this whole thing with Hooded Justice and Metropolis is Cook is going. He's saying, all right, this is how it went down. And I suppose that's fair game, you know, because all this was alluded to in Watchmen.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I think it's a pretty good. Well, let's talk about the end. Let's
go
just
ahead.
Continue. Then we see the little boy in the circus again. He comes up to the cages, the circus cages, and we see what looks like a bunch of little boys or hands or people inside the cages, not animals like you would think, but all these hands come reaching out and startle the boy, and you assume that like they're pleading for him to help him. Then we go back to Night Owl, Silhouette, and Mothman. They come on Mothman, and he's crying. He's the one crying.
Yeah.
And they come in the room, and the final three sequences, the boy runs away from the train. He thinks he's safe, but then he turns and looks, and there's a shadowy figure in the distance. In the Metropolis and Hooded Justice scene, we see Hooded Justice now, the view is from over
He's
Metropolis.
Dancing around him at this point.
Yeah, he's standing over him, and he says, "Shh, it's okay." And then we see the Night Owl, Silhouette, Mothman scene, and they're looking on a hanging body. It looks like someone has hung themselves or been hung in this room. And that's the end. I had a lot of questions at this one. Things were moving along pretty smoothly for me on this book until I got to this whole three intertwining storyline sequence. And I'm not sure. I read it a couple of times. It gave me a bunch of questions, which isn't a bad thing. But we see, if we just want to take each sequence, we see with Hooded Justice Metropolis, obviously, it's the beginning of their sexual relationship. And
yeah, it's just defining it, you know.
And you see more of that, dominatrix sort of, or domination, not dominatrix, but Justice, dominating Captain Metropolis in this. With the boy, I wasn't sure who that was or if it's going to be someone that comes up later in the book. I'm assuming so.
I'm assuming that it's probably, since it's a German, it's Hooded Justice.
Is it Hooded Justice? Maybe his origin, why he became...
And I actually just figured that out while listening to you.
Oh,
because I missed the fact that it was, when you said German, it was a German... Service.
Well, I'm assuming, I don't really speak German, but I mean, it looks like Frau, all the words in the scene are Hauptzeit.
Yeah,
and
1920.
Yeah.
They went to a lot of trouble to put us, in a place and a time with those things. So I think they're trying to say
it would make sense if he was in fact the German strongman Rolf, whatever it was.
And you know, seeing how those two storylines are kind of connected by the single thing of Hooded Justice, I'm wondering if the third storyline, which is them going on this hanging of, and maybe of sexual in nature, because we got bloodied ropes and stuff, you know, maybe that's,
well, here's you know,
Justice as well.
I think what I was thinking is that's his work.
That's what I'm saying, yeah,
because it looks like the person hanging is not a child. I mean, it's a, it looks like a,
yeah,
a pretty tall, like a man. Person. And we see like a knife underneath him. We see blood. So yeah, is this handiwork of Hooded Justice? Is this the guy that from the circus when he was a child, or is this, you know, is this just someone that he found and this is how he handles things? I mean, from his history, you know, like the first appearance of him, he, you know, like broke a dude's spine, you know, beating the shit. Like it was some guy was attacked a woman or something, and he, you know, beat him so bad he put him in the hospital and broke his spine and lost the use of his leg. So, so yeah, I mean, this issue to me is very much about Hooded Justice. So I think we can kind of maybe assume,
yeah,
that, yes, that boy and that, you know, the boy is Hooded Justice as a young man who
yeah,
happens upon.
And that's, you know, this is even this is awesome to tear this apart with you on the podcast here, because I didn't really tie all of those. And even with the third, which, you know, maybe not, it has something to do with Hooded Justice, the third being Silhouette and Night Owl going through that old house or whatever. But I'm kind of thinking maybe it is. So.
I am now too. I mean, I didn't really think of that until you mentioned it. I had thought maybe the kid was Hooded Justice, but I didn't think that I was confused by the third one because I wasn't sure what that had to do. But now that you mention it, that makes sense. That they've now, while Silhouette was trying to find this guy that was, you know, trafficking children, Hooded Justice has already found him and dealt with him in the harshest possible way. You know, he's ended him. You know, and so yeah, that's, I mean, I think this whole issue is very interesting when it comes to the Hooded Justice character and what we find out about him. And I think it opens up some more questions about him too, about, you know, what is it about him that makes him this incredibly violent person, not only in, you know, his life as a crime fighter, but in his personal life, his sexual, you know, fulfillment.
I'm inclined to believe that in the issues to come, we're going to see some pretty foul shit happen to this poor young Hooded Justice, you know.
Young German boy. I'm not sure what that scene represents. If it's, it could be, you know, a circus cover up for trafficking in young children. The other thought that popped in my head was, it's 1920. Is that too early? I guess that would have been too early to really, think about Nazis, you know.
Yeah, I don't think they're going that route with it. There's enough.
I just
bad
thought that,
guys
like the train,
the team to
like
concentrate on
the train and train full of kids, you know what I mean, or a train full of people that just automatically in Germany that automatically popped in my head of, but that may just be, you know, coincidental.
Just a place to hold them.
Just happens to be a train. We'll see.
Yeah.
And yeah, so, I think it was a pretty good issue. I thought, I
thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I thought that, and I guess, you know, I've heard this before with first issues of comics and series and as stories start that there's a job that the first issue has to do often,
sure,
with many stories, and it's to kind of set up. So, and the first issue of Minutemen was certainly like that. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of cool things about it, I guess, just kind of bringing you up to speed. But this one is definitely, we're delving into a story that I'm really interested in. I don't know. I think that, and, you know, and I guess as far as the 1940s, that homosexuality would be such a big deal. Oh, but absolutely. it's really played up here. I mean, because Ursula is a lesbian, Captain Metropolis is gay, and Hooded Justice is gay, and it seems like it's made out to be this huge. But I guess back then it would be, you know, it, by those standards that.
Well, I think if you look at, you know, like I said, if you look at now information that has come out about actors or actresses at, you know, at that time or later that hid their sexuality because of that, because the public wasn't willing to accept it. So, I mean, you're looking at, you know, a group of characters that are, you know, vigilantes basically are trying to garner, you know, a public awareness and a public acceptance. It would be something that, you know, that in 1939,
that they got to get control of, or
they just have to keep it hidden. I mean, that's, you know, that's just the way that it was at that time. And it for them to come out and, you know, you got to remember at that time, I mean, homosexuality was looked at as criminal and a psychosis, it was looked at like a sickness, not, you know, so if you had, now all of a sudden you had Hooded Justice come out and say that he was homosexual, everyone would look at his feats as the acts of a, you know, a
crazy man.
Yeah, crazy, you know, someone who's insane, who's incredibly violent and, you know, and gay. And those two things would be based on the same thing. You know what I mean? Like, they would be looked at as the same sort of.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, right. And, so I, you know, it makes complete sense that they would try and cover it up, that they would want to keep it out of the public as much as possible, because they're trying to get the public's, you know, acceptance, because that's where their success lies. Yeah. It, you know, it's definitely, it's a heavy part of this book so far. You know, this issue specifically, but I think, you know, we're also just sort of, you know, looking at Justice in this issue. I don't know if each issue is going to be sort of a different character to some degree. I did think it was kind of interesting that, you know, in the first issue, it was pretty much all from Hollis's perspective. And then in this one, it starts out that way, but then it transitions pretty quickly to more of an omniscient viewpoint. And, you know, we don't have it because there's things here that Hollis wouldn't have known of or wouldn't have seen firsthand. So, sort of interesting that, you know, he made that change pretty quickly. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see if he goes back to sort of switching between the narration that way.
Well, just trying to think ahead, as where Darwin Cook is going to go with this. And what do we know about Hooded Justice from The Watchmen? We know that he disappeared, right?
Yes, he did. He did disappear when the Senate subcommittee hearings of the House of Un-American Activities Committee asked all of the, you know, masked men to show their true identities to them. He refused to. He was one of the few that did, and instead he just disappeared. And then, you know, he wasn't ever seen again, and there was a lot of different theories as to what happened to him. You know, Rolf Mueller was the German strongman, and his body was actually found a few years after Hooded Justice disappeared. I think it was found in a lake or something, and he was killed. He was murdered. He was like shot in the head. So, you know, there was theories.
Rolf Mueller was a circus strongman, was he?
He was. Yes, he was circus strongman. So yeah, there's an interesting connection there.
Yep. Just saying.
So yeah, it appears as if, you know, that's the course that Darwin is taking, that this is, you know, Rolf. But we'll see. Who knows? But then there was also speculation that he faked his own death. And I know that there's a panel in Watchmen. I think it's the first issue. Where there's a scene of Nelson, what people think are Nelson and Rolf together in 1985, like in a restaurant.
In Watchmen,
the original Watchmen. There's a panel. Now it's never been verified that that is them, but people have thought that that panel. There's two characters together in a I think it's a restaurant or is it a bar?
Take a picture of it and text it to me.
Oh, jeez.
Was it something that the narrative stated?
It's the restaurant that, remember...
Or did you hear it from some comic book guy saying...
No, this, yeah, this is completely, like, you know, comic people looking at it and, like, trying to analyze it.
I said it was
not verified. This was never verified. No one ever... Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons never said anything about it. It was, but in the restaurant that Dan and Lori go to for dinner, there's a panel and there's two characters, and people have come to theorize that that is actually Nelson and Hooded Justice together.
Well, and the Watchmen was Nelson and Hooded Justice made to be a couple in Watchmen anywhere?
I believe in Under the Hood the text pieces under the hood from Hollis's book, yes, that it was.
Okay. Well,
I don't know if it was
I
don't know if
that makes sense that supposition would be made that they would be together.
Yeah, I believe.
I want to see your text in that to me. Do not do that because I want to see it.
Okay. No, go look it up. You have Watchmen, don't you?
Not with me.
Oh well. I'll try and find it. I have the absolute, so I'll look it up in there.
Oh, man, see, it'll be a great clear picture and everything.
It should be, yeah. It should be as good a picture as we'll have of it. So, but yeah, I believe that in Under the Hood it was intimated. I don't know if it was, you know, expressly said that they were in a relationship.
No, they everything was real. Subtle and nothing was ever definite in Watchmen, which Darwin Cook is definitely showing you how it went down, which I'm for it, man. I think we're probably going to this. I don't know how much of his story is going to be about the Hooded Justice and the mystery of whatever happened to him, who he was and all that. But there's a lot of material that could be drawn upon from that character, and I think that's probably what Cook is doing, which I hope he does. He's interesting. This is interesting to me.
I think I think what he's doing is he's writing a team book. I mean, he's using the events. He's looking at the original, you know, Watchmen, and then he's pulling, extracting from there certain things, and then he's written this tale that, you know, so far we've sort of seen a little bit of everybody. You know, this one was more focused on Metropolis and Justice and Silhouette, you know, for the most part. But at the same time, you know, we've seen a little bit of everybody in two issues. So I don't know that it's necessarily going to focus.
He's introducing a lot of questions that, you know, future issues are going to have to answer. I don't see us getting into the Mothman. Could be wrong.
Do they have to answer? I mean, you just said yourself, like, nothing was ever expressly stated in Watchmen. Why can't it? This
that's
be
Alan Moore. This is Darwin Cook. I mean, but you could be right. I don't know if he's going to do it or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not. You know, who knows? But I think, you know, for me, he's doing a very good job of, you know, walking that line of going, well, this is what I think things happen. But he's also staying logical to the original Watchmen and saying, okay, well, this is what I read in it, this is what we know, and I'm going to pull from that. I'm going to sort of deduce how I think things may have went down, and I'm going to show you that.
Yeah.
And I think he's, but at the same time, he's also telling you a story. It's not just like an expose or shedding light on things that have happened. You know, like a documentary. It's also there's an interesting story here. So I think he's doing, so far in two issues, he's done a really good job of you know, skirting that line.
So you like it? I mean, you like the story? I mean, you got any complaints?
You know, I did before we sat down and figured out that last couple of pages. But you know, once now realizing that I think that's, you know, young.
We should read every comic book together. You know that?
So
think of the enjoyment we would have.
Because we only really have one good brain between us.
Yeah. I'd phone everything in, but you kind of fill in the gaps. It's like the Smothers Brothers, you and I.
Great. Well, why don't you take it? All right, well, now we do have to, we would be remiss.
Oh, I forgot.
The Curse of the Crimson Corsair. We have that back up in the back. Why don't you take it through? Yeah, take us through this two pages here.
Let me take you through this little thing called The Curse of the Crimson Corsair, Brian Ruben Salazar.
Whoa, throwing out my middle name to people.
So our protagonist is still adrift, and he's coming under the shadow of a stinky large ship, and some very cadaverous hands pull him on board. I love that phrase, cadaverous. And they lay him on the ship. They splash water on his face, and then he wakes up full of piss and vinegar because they splash water on his face, which I kind of felt was a little, you know, weird. Out of character. You know, you're thankful to be alive, and you somebody splashes water on your face, and you're like, I'll gut you for that. That's what he said. He said, I'll gut you for doing whoever did that, and who did it was the Crimson Corsair, and we don't really know what his intentions are at this point. That's basically the gist of it. They pulled him onto the boat, and splashed water on him, and
we see
this
fancy pirate,
Milli Vanilli type.
Yeah, I was thinking he has like a Gucci headband on. It's got the C, a backward CC. On his headband for Crimson Corsair. That was a little weird.
Yeah, he's really, I mean, he looks kind of 90-esque, you know, from 1990s, maybe.
He's ripped. He's, you know, he's got some musculature to him. He's don't wearing like
blame
a vest.
It on the rain.
Yeah, he's definitely Milli Vanilli-ish. He's got the braids and the headband, and yeah.
Well, I was on the forum earlier, and one of our forumites had told us to really pay attention to this particular yarn, and I immediately went back and looked over to see what he was talking about. And the only thing I noticed was in the background of the Crimson Corsair was this. It looked like a crew member. Maybe that's a head, just sitting there. Maybe tied up or chained up or something.
Well, to me, it looks like you have a couple of slaves, you know, chained up, and that's what I think is going to happen to our protagonist, at least for the timing, because it looks like he's chained up as well. Or, I don't know, there's chains behind him. I'm not sure if he's chained.
No, I don't know. I mean, the way he says no, is that any way to talk to him whom you owe your salvation?
It's a weird background. I mean, you see like
I don't
a skull
know
thing.
If he's, yeah.
You see like a dude that kind of looks like the Flash villain, Captain Cold.
Captain Cold.
And then you see like a white-haired, strange-looking guy. I don't know. I'm not sure what the guy is talking about. Like, I don't see anything here.
Yeah, I poured over. He might just be pulling a joke on us just to.
Well, you never know what people see either. I mean, you just, you know, you're not sure. They may assume something is there that we don't see. I don't know who this guy is. This Crimson Corsair is not. It's not that impressive to me. But
where have I seen this guy before? I mean, was he? Did they have illustration? Because I saw this headband before somewhere. Did they have illustrations of the Crimson Corsair?
I don't like. I don't remember seeing
it. Ads for the before watch. I could. I swear I've seen that before.
I don't know.
Gosh, I may have dreamt it.
Fever dream. Hey, yeah. I was gonna. You know, it's funny. There was. You know, this is probably just me looking at things a little too deep, but. Going back to the Minutemen story in this issue, there's a part where they're in the malt factory, you know, their lair, their fortress of multitude. and the meeting's sort of over and you have Metropolis talking to Night Owl and he says, "Hey, I hope you find the meeting room inspiring. I had the wood brought here on a ship from Africa." And when I read that, I was like, well, that's a weird, like, why would he say that? And then I started thinking about, like, the whole Black Freighter and the pirate thing. And, like, I don't know why. I mean, I have no idea if there's any connection there whatsoever. But for some reason, that's what I thought about when I read that. Like,
there's a reason that Cook decided to throw that in. And I don't know if he did that because there's he's making reference to something, or he's giving a nod to something, or
I'm not sure.
Just, if maybe Nelson said it because he's playing to the stereotype that homosexuals are you know, keen on.
Designing their
design. And
maybe that's what it is. Yeah. I didn't think of it that way, but yeah, that's possible. I don't, yeah. It just was a weird, like it stuck out to me for some strange reason. Like that's odd. Like why? You know, and
yeah,
if you look at
it, I remember reading it and being like, oh, I wonder what that's all about.
Yeah. But all right, well, so yeah, I mean, I think, you know, overall this was good. I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to the next one. I think Cook is doing a really good job to me, like I said, of the extrapolation from what we know and staying in line with what Moore had originally put down, but adding a new perspective to things, you know, going on a little deeper and seeing stuff. So,
yeah, there was a lot on the second issue, I think. And, you know, this is the first of the second issues and I enjoyed it. I think we're on the right track. Definitely agree with you, Sal. We're in keeping with the Watchmen. I don't feel like we're in some crazy new territory.
Right.
The art is great. I mean,
yeah,
I'm on board with it. And
although there has, once again, like there was another panel in here that, you know, it was the panel with Metropolis and Justice where he put the rope in his mouth. Like that was weird, you know, and it's like for Darwin Cook, you know, so far both issues, there's been like a weird, you know, thing. Like I still don't know. Oh, that was, I wanted to bring that up. Like somebody had said on the forum, remember we had asked on the first issue of Minutemen,
yeah,
said, you know, there was that strange panel that looked like a sewer drain, but we weren't sure what the hell it was. And, you know, somebody had said maybe it was like someone looking out of a sewer drain and seeing Mothman. It looked like Mothman's wing. So I don't know if that has part. I mean, it still didn't quite answer what that scene is.
No, they were just doing what we were doing.
I should have asked like Ron Richards of iFanboy to ask Darwin what the fuck that was. Well, he was at San Diego Comic-Con because he hangs out with Darwin.
Yeah. Well, there. I listened to those guys and according to, I guess, a dialogue with Cook, we're in store for some pretty good things with this series. So.
Well, so far I'm happy. I've enjoyed it, so. All righty. Well, you have anything else to add? Is that pretty much?
No, that's it. That's pretty much it. Next, what are we getting next?
Silk Spectre #2 will be next week.
Aren't we supposed to get Rorschach?
Rorschach, I think, is
and
the Dr. week
Manhattan?
After. I think those are both the week after. They would be during the third issues because they're only 4-issue series. So you'd have 1-2 and then 3-3-3-1-1. You know, so it's, I think they'll all end at the same time is what they're looking to do. So next week should be Silk Spectre #2. And then after that, I believe will be Rorschach #1, I believe.
Well, I'm looking forward to Silk Spectre #2, man. We're going to be in San Francisco.
Hippies and pop.
Hippies and hanging out in the Mystery Machine.
Free sex
and free sex,
good drugs, and yeah, all that good stuff. So yeah, it should be cool. Well, thank you once again for listening. We really appreciate it. Make sure if you have something to tell us, like we're morons or we're geniuses, you know, we get told both, or you know, have another perspective on this issue or something else, please either send us an email at info@aroundcomics. You can tweet us at Around Comics. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/aroundcomics. We have our website, www.aroundcomics.com. We have a forum there. You can go on and give us your thoughts. Or you can just post comments on the individual episode threads. There's lots and lots of ways to, you know, kind of mingle with us and talk to us and tell us whatever you want to tell us. So
tell us you love us. Tell us that this show is, you know what, this has helped.
And if you want to tell
complexion. Yeah. Clear up my complexion.
You can also go on to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review. Give us a positive or negative, however you feel. iTunes review. Yeah, plenty of ways to get a hold of us. Also want to mention that this episode is sponsored by Discount Comic Book Service, dcbservice.com. You can get your comics there for up to 50, sometimes like crazy 75% off sometimes for stuff.
It's ridiculous. They pay you at that point.
Yeah, right. And then I know there's a deal on the Watchmen stuff. So if you want to pick up that, yeah, go there and get it. DCBService.com. And that's it. That's another episode. Thank you for listening. All right.
See you next time.
Thank you for joining me, Braxton. Always fun. And
always fun.
Adios, motherfuckers.
Are we really going to do that? Let's not do that.
I just did it. Well, what are we going to do? We got to have some kind of sign off.
I kind of was into the just telling everyone I love you.
No, I'm not. No, that's.
That listen, just.
I love my wife. Really, I love my kids. You know, people I've never met. I'm, you know,
adios, motherfuckers.
All right. How about we just say.
The show's over.
That's kind of boring.
We don't know how to end it.
How about until next week, true believers? No.
It's been done, I think.
Same bat time, same bat channel? No.
That's definitely been done. All right, let's just end it.
Fuck it.
Look, just tune in next time. All just right. Be with us as Fine. We go through this.
Fine.
Be with us. That's it. Be with us.
Shut up so we can end it.
Us.
Adios, motherfuckers.
When children are playing alone on the green, in comes the playmate that never was seen. When children are happy and lonely and good, the friend of the children comes out of the wood. Nobody heard him and nobody saw. His is a picture you never could draw. But he's sure to be present, abroad or at home, when children are happy and playing alone. He lies in the laurels, he runs on the grass, he sings when you tinkle the musical glass. Whene'er you are happy and cannot tell why, the friend of the children is sure to be by. He loves to be little, he hates to be big. 'Tis he that inhabits the caves that you dig. 'Tis he when you play with your soldiers of tin that sides with the Frenchmen and never can win. 'Tis he when at night you go off to your bed, bids you go to your sleep and not trouble your head. For wherever they're lying, in cupboard or shelf, 'tis he will take care of your playthings himself.